Here on the show, we are keeping the straight ahead 10-foot pole fun going on the show with Dennis Yaggard of 10-foot pole. More on that in 1 second. This is a great episode. This is a very a revealing episode. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That and the Facebook page and the Instagram page and the Tumblr, people, I don't think we do that anymore, but there was a Tumblr page, and all that is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham. Thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do for the show each and every week, and for being my brother and putting up with me. You know, he puts up with a lot of late night phone calls and things like that, so I really appreciate it. I love you, buddy. But if you're looking to get in touch with me more directly, you can also send me messages on Instagram and Twitter at Left4Damien. If you want to support the show, the best way to support the show is just by telling all your friends about it, letting everyone know that you enjoy this podcast here each and every week or each and every episode, because a lot of times it's more than one episode a week. And that is a great way to support. You can also subscribe to it and rate it on your platform of choice. And you can head over to patreon.com/turnedoutapunk. Thank you, thank you, thank you to each and every one of you that have done that. We over there do Turned Out a Punk footnotes, put each of those up each and every week. And we've got some monster footnotes recently. Chris O'Toole and I are diving deep on episodes, and that has been a lot of fun. So yeah, check those ones out over there at patreon.com/turnedoutapunk. Speaking of support, this thing would not be possible without the kind, loving support of the fine folks at Vans, who came aboard a few years ago and said, "Damien, do what you do. Just, you know, hopefully you can do it without losing too much money on it." And they have helped me kind of cover the cost of this thing, and it's been very much appreciated. Thank you very much to Vans for all of that. And when House of Vans comes back, hopefully they will have me back, and I will be, appearing at those things. And they will be back one day. One day, everyone wear a mask, but one day, hopefully it'll all be back. But in the meantime, we will be here at Turned Out a Punk, giving you conversations with people and communicating with you that way. So thank you, everyone who supports this podcast. I really appreciate it. And there's a lot of you. There's a sizable amount of you who come in each and every week and check out what we're doing here. And I don't say thank you to you enough. So thank you very much for checking out this show. All right. Speaking of this show, on this episode, we got Dennis Yaggard of the band 10-Foot Pole of Scared Straight. And, a band that played a big role on me. I started telling Dennis about it in the episode, but we never really get to the story. But my brother and I and our friend David Wang went on a trip to Montreal together, a very formative trip. One, David Wang got his driver's license, and we drove at breakneck speeds, legal speeds, you know, mostly legal speeds. It was not a very fast car, but we got there in time, and we did get a chance to see 10-Foot Pole play on the Unleashed record. And they brought out Reset, who of course went on to become Simple Plan, to do a mini set in the middle of their set. And it was at the height of this kind of music in Montreal. So there was like 1,000 people there. Anyway, it was a huge show for myself and my brother. And 10-Foot Pole has been a band, you know, once again, I tell Dennis this on the episode, they were a band that was key to me on this journey, because they were the band that exposed me to the idea that a band that I could like from the present day could have this amazing past that I needed to explore, which is, believe me, something I, as you know from listening to the show, do all the time now. But 10-Foot Pole opened the door to Scared Straight, which opened the door to Mystic Records, and my gosh, it was like that scene in Wizard of Oz when Dorothy opens the door and all of a sudden everything's in color once I discovered Mystic Records. So I had to get Dennis on the show, and I thought, what better way to follow up Scott Radinsky? And of course, you know, we called it here on the show, LA Dodgers epic World Series win, Scott's former team, and also the first team I ever saw play live in person. So we congratulate them on their win. And what better way to follow it up is then with another member of the Scared Straight 10-Foot Pole roster. Dennis took over on vocals once Scott did depart the band and kept the band going. And this is a revealing episode. I think he opens up and lets us in on the realities of being a touring musician and kind of following your dreams and trying to make it work. And I can relate to that profoundly. And I think a lot of musicians can relate to this story and the struggle very much, you know, because it is something that we all go through and there's constant regret. Anyway, I'm not going to spoil it anymore. I want you to listen to this thing. It is a fascinating conversation. And that is it. Check out his brand new acoustic EP. Check out tenfootpole.com. And I will see you on the other side. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Dennis Yeagard on Turned Out a Punk. Dennis, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
Well, I spared you from this off air before we were when we were just doing that little preamble, but I'm a massive fan, and you know, the Unleashed record holds such a special...
like 6'4", 300. What?
Oh, I'm 6'2".
You got to quantify how big you are when you say massive. Like, I'm, you know, picturing He-Man.
I'm about 6'1", 6'2", on a good day, and about 300 pounds on a not so good day. So yeah, I'm a pretty big fan. I mean, literally as well as figuratively. But I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time.
You did
time.
Mention wrestling in the preamble. So I hate to interrupt before you even ask your first question, but so I thought it was fair for me to ask how much you bench, because considering that you already made a reference to wrestling, I have to assume that you have professional wrestling experience. Is that true?
No, but I did do a documentary TV series about pro wrestling.
Oh, nice.
For Vice a couple years ago. So I'm actually, yeah, I'm punk rock is my number one obsession, but right underneath it is pro wrestling. And so
I knew it. So you're benching 350, but only 300 on a bad day, you said.
I the only benching I do is crates of records up and down the stairs as I'm trying to move them around the house to make room.
Nice. I'm not a weightlifter, by the way, in case anyone's listening and they're like, bro, does that guy even lift? I actually, the only exercise I do, like, I have been exercising a lot, but the only exercise I do is with my dog. It's she's an Australian cattle dog. And we basically play tug of war with the rope, and I try to shift my angles to get lots of good pulls for my back. But basically that's it. Like, when I do biceps, I'm like lifting her up with, you know, my, and she jerks her neck and tries to tear my rotator cuff. But other than that, it's pretty fun workout because I got company.
Well, it's good cardio, it sounds like.
Well, it's a lot of resistance training. Like, you know, she's not a pit bull, but it's the same kind of thing. Like, she has a really strong neck and she throws her whole body into it. So, you know, she's maybe only 40 pounds, but when she throws herself against you, it's the dynamic weight of that. I don't know what it is, but it's a lot more than 40 pounds.
Well, you're about to experience the dynamic weight of punk punishment in a second, but I got to start this off, Dennis, the way they all start off, which is, how did you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
As a musician / artist / performer, or just as a fan?
In any capacity.
We got to qualify this.
In any capacity, yeah. Just like even the first time you heard the word.
The first time I was exposed to it, I have to take you back here. So my father was a defense contractor making inertial navigation systems for guided missiles when I was a kid. And so, you know, he was really into the bomb building and all that kind of things that they were doing in the Cold War in the 70s. But on the side, because of his family background, he had a background in audio and film. And so he had a side business. And we also had stages. And so when I was about 10 years old, we had all these wood stages that we kept in our backyard and we would drag them out. Pixie, no barking. You said you'd be good. That's my workout partner there. She's kind of crying in the background. Oh. Probably having a disagreement with her mom about something. Hey, you have to be good if you want to stay in here. But anyhow, so my dad had a sound film and stage company, which had these wood stages. And when I was about 10 years old, he goes, okay, come on, we got to go, you know, take down these stages. And we went to a place called Devonshire Downs, which is now part of the Cal State Northridge campus. But at the time, it was basically a big fairgrounds, like kind of a big empty building that they had fairs in. And there was this band playing called Black Flag. And my dad grabs the corner of the stage while they're on stage performing. and says, "Well, that's it. It's 1 o'clock. We're supposed to be done. Let's pull it out." and like, you know, in the '90s when I was doing like later, like, you know, 25 years after that, mm-hmm. punk was a lot more, what's the word? Safe.
Yeah.
When like in the 10-foot pole touring over the years, like the people who come to our shows for the most part are friendly, respectful. You know, they might be kind of dicks here and there, but a Black Flag show in 1979, it was more like, you know, a lot of like leather and, you know, switchblade knives. And like, like punk back then was like kind of really like people who were bullied too much and were kind of dirty, greasy, vicious looking. I'll tell you a different story later if you remind me. I don't want to go off on a different story, but I have a different story about how vicious it can be. But at the time, I was a 10, 11-year-old kid, and my dad was trying to pull the wood stage out from under Black Flag while there were 1,000 people in the audience who looked mean.
Yeah.
At least to a 10-year-old kid. They weren't like friendly skate punks. They were like, you know, Black Flag fans. And so I'm like, "Dad, let's go to Denny's and have some pancakes," you know. And he couldn't resist that. So, like, you know, there was a Denny's right down the street. So we went and ate, then came back when the show was over and pulled the stage. So basically I kept my dad from at least getting his ass kicked, probably getting shanked. I mean, who knows? But yeah, so that was the first punk show I went to.
That's amazing. Well, that's like, and also like, you know, you're talking about how hairy it could get, especially in that part of the world, like Southern California really is the sort of epicenter of like, you know, hardcore, like the idea of like, you know, not just punk rock, but the idea of being the hardest element of punk rock. And as you're saying it, like it attracted people that felt rejected from society.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny that, you know, we say this and I say that, you know, punk crowds are generally like kind and whatnot, but I think like the world is kind of going back into a very mean place where people do like draw guns on each other and stuff is getting totally gnarly because of political reasons and because of wealth stratification. I ultimately think that's what it is because that people are just seeing the poverty go up, you know? And so, but anyway, at the time I didn't really think much about it, but a couple years later I had friends who brought me into kind of the music of punk and really just kind of opened my whole world to how interesting and like the lyrics of punk music to me were just much more real than a lot of the other music. I liked other music at the time, like Black Sabbath and Iron Maiden and Van Halen and AC/DC and the kind of stuff that a 12-year-old kid would like in 1982 or 1981. But once I heard the lyrics of Minor Threat and Fear and Social Distortion and Youth Brigade and 7 Seconds, like all that kind of stuff, it just opened a whole different world. Like instead of singing like Van Halen, like 80% of the songs are about love or making love or, you know, it's just like, I mean, that was kind of what rock music was at the time. I mean, obviously Black Sabbath's different, which is why I liked them. You know, it's like they were about death and whatnot. But the average rock band was just all about love and sex and drugs and rock and roll. And the average pop band was all about just love. Like that's all it was, you know, 80% of it. Mm-hmm. And to hear these songs about friendship or foreign policy or, you know, stuff like that was just like, wow. And so that was right at the time when I wanted to start making music. And so, I could barely play the guitar. And so it was just kind of exciting to be somewhere where you could make a song without that much skill that was fairly interesting and say something that you thought was important. And people at a party would drink and go crazy and jump all over each other and have a crazy wild time. And that's how I got into it. It was kind of that combination of energy, simplicity, and yet lyrics about things that seemed pertinent and real and important.
Where were you getting into that music prior to punk rock? Like sort of that heavy rock stuff. Was it through the radio or magazines or what was the gateway to that kind of stuff?
I would say radio kind of opened my eyes to the kind of music that was out there. But then at that time, like, it was more like hearing it from friends. And I just was thinking, I didn't listen to Van Halen that much, but since Eddie Van Halen just passed, rest in peace. I was thinking about that just like my neighbor, there was this stoner that was always trying to get me to smoke pot with him. And I was, you know, 10 years old, but, like he wasn't my pal, but they were playing Jamie's Crying one day in front of their house and skateboarding. And it was like, oh, that's really cool. And what is that? You know, I asked them and they're like, it's Van Halen one, or, you know, I don't know whether it was called one at the time, but there's like, it's this Van Halen record, you know? Yeah. And back in those days, like if it wasn't on the radio, your only option was kind of to hear it from friends or to go to a record store and see what the cover looked like and buy it and then take it home and see if you liked it. Or join Columbia Records where for 13, you get 13 for a penny. And there were a lot of weird things about judging music by its cover. I'll use an example. My biggest disappointment was Molly Hatchet, because they had the most scary, evil looking covers. And then I started playing it and the guy's all, I'm going down the road and I'm flirting with disaster. And I was like, oh my God, this is horrible. You know, because I was thinking from the cover that it would be like, you know, dark and evil, like Black Sabbath.
Yeah. No, I feel the same way about Grateful Dead. You know, I think I saw the shirts and I saw the skull and I'm like, oh, this is going to sound one way. And then you hear it, you're like, that's not it.
Trucking. Yeah. There's a few Dead songs that I like. And I've gone to a couple of shows. And I went to UC Berkeley. So I hung out with some, you know, people who were in deeper into that scene and hung out with them kind of more for the experience than any kind of love of music. There's probably like five Grateful Dead songs that I like. And then I just can't hang with all the wanking. I think it's interesting that people like jam bands and that they play it different all the time and they're improvising on solos, but I don't find solos kind of inherently interesting. And that's why I'm not a big jazz fan. It's like, I appreciate that there's a lot of thought and, musical stuff behind what jazz people do, but if there's not like lyrics and a melody I can follow,
you know, I relate. I definitely.
I did one jazz tour where I was literally doing push-ups to stay awake. I was on the side of the stage as the monitor engineer. I won't tell you what act, but hold 1 second. I'm gonna call for help here.
Going back to that first show, that Black Flag show, I guess that would have been Keith Morris kind of era, right? Like, I'm sure you probably have very little recollection being a kid at that point, but that was super early on into the band's kind of career.
Yeah, I can't say. I've looked back to see if I could guess when it was, but they played at the Devonshire Downs was a pretty popular place, and they played there quite a bit. So it could have been a few different people. Because I don't even know the exact time. I'm guessing 1979. I'm guessing I was 11, 10, but it could have been 78 or it could have been 80. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, it's all a blur at this point. I try to say it like I know what I'm talking about, but I sometimes have a false sense of historical accuracy just because I don't want to go into this on every story I tell. I'll say it like it's a fact, but just know there's a little bit of leeway. Could be plus or minus 3 years when we're talking about 40 years ago.
That's well within the margin of error. So that's completely understandable.
Yeah. 10%. Let's give me a 10% leeway, whether it's intentional or unintentional. I would request a 10% leeway on historical accuracy.
Well, it will be given. And going back, those friends that you mentioned that kind of brought you in, what was the stuff that they played you initially that really kind of hooked you? Or what were there bands that you kind of, you heard and you're like, okay, this is what I wanted?
Yeah, there was a variety of stuff. So I grew up in Simi Valley, which was on the edge of Ventura County. And the towns around us included Oxnard, which became famous for Oxnard Hardcore, otherwise known as Nardcore. And there was a record on Mystic Records called Nardcore, which they invited us to be on, even though we weren't technically Oxnard, but we were just over the hill from Oxnard. And we ended up touring with Ill Repute in 1985. So, well, I should back up. So before 10 Foot Pole was 10 Foot Pole, we were called Scared Straight. Mm-hmm. And we just changed the name to 10 Foot Pole for a variety of reasons. But Scared Straight in 1985 on our first big tour was in 1985, supporting Ill Repute in the summer of 85. And that was around the time the album, the Oxnard, the Nardcore album had been out. In fact, by then, I think we had an EP, which was a 9-song EP, which we were proud of and stoked to be, like, we were barely driving and crossing the country. And so, but before we did the tour, we played a lot of parties. And so, so the bands that we knew locally from actually seeing them were bands like Stalag 13 and Aggression, Dr. No, Ill Repute, were these, you know, kind of LA or Oxnard or whatever it was bands. And then, you know, being in LA, we saw other bands came to town. Like, in fact, one of my biggest bummers is that I missed Minor Threat. Like, right after Minor Threat came to town is when I got into them, because all my friends were like, oh, that Minor Threat show was so great. And I'm like, oh, who's that? And then I started listening. I was like, oh my God, I missed it. And, but there were other bands that came through town that, that we got to see, and, you know, like Exploited and Heart Attack. And I can't even say all the bands are just, we started going to places like the Cafe de Grand in Hollywood, and, cause we were playing there, but we also would go as fans sometimes and just, and see whatever bands, Government Issue and Scream and, I can't even say all the bands. Negative Approach was one of my favorites when I was back then.
Oh, damn. They didn't come out and play, though, right? I don't think they ever made it out west, did they?
No, I didn't see them, but you were asking, like, what music I listened to. And, in fact, you mentioned, you know, Brian Walsby, and Brian Walsby is one of the people who brought vinyl records over to my house and said, you have to hear this band, like, 76% Uncertain. They had a song called Coffee Achiever. I'm a coffee achiever, can't you see? Did it? I tried to find that on Spotify and it wasn't there. That was disappointing. But because I was trying to make a Spotify playlist of some of my favorite old punk songs.
I think it's on YouTube, though, that record, definitely. Because I was listening to it the other day, weirdly.
I was trying to make a Spotify playlist just in case I ever wanted to, like, say, you know, these are some of my favorite stuff. Like, I haven't, you know, advertised it or anything, but I thought maybe that's something I should do, you know. Yeah. Just in case someone like you said, hey, what were your favorite songs? I could say, well, it's just check out my playlist. And then I'd put some 10-foot pole in there, and then people will listen to my music accidentally. So anyway, but yeah, Walsby, Mike Thompson, the singer of our band. So Scott Rudinsky was the singer when we became 10-foot pole. But and as Scared Straight, but before him, there were actually like three different singers, and one of them, Mike Thompson, he was like a tough guy punk, and he was really into like Fear and Circle One and what else, just like really tough punk, and then I had other friends who were into peace punk, and it was just kind of, you know, so different people showed me different stuff. And you know, like I wasn't totally down with Fear's politics, but I did like the sound of their record, like the Fear album, like the song like Camarillo and Foreign Policy. And, you know, there was like the typical I Don't Care About You songs. Mm-hmm. But there were other songs that actually sounded really good, like the sonics of them were really good. And that kind of surprised me, because as a kid, I just always thought, well, punk is just going to be, you know, kind of sound like garbage. But bands like that, some of them sounded really good. And so that was kind of exciting to be open to this whole underground culture that you would never hear those songs on the radio, except for Rodney on the Rock. Rodney Bingenheimer. Mm-hmm. used to have a radio show with some cool songs, like once a week on Sunday night or something. And but back in those days, you know, you couldn't just sample music. Later, there became record stores where you could listen with headphones to music, but that didn't exist, at least in my world, in the 70s and 80s. Like, you couldn't sample anything. So you just, you know, you looked at the cover. And in fact, I bought Black Flag Fade to Black because I had seen them at that concert and not really known any of their songs. And because it was kind of a best of, I thought. And like, I bought that record, like having no idea what they sounded like. But like kind of like, you know, right in the beginning of all that, was kind of like, well, that band's obviously big. 1,000 people was there watching them, and they kicked ass. I mean, they're, you know, I don't know who the singer was, but they were, you know, it was an aggressive band. And so I bought the record based on that and the cover.
So what was, do you remember the second punk show you went to then?
Well, I don't know. I have another memory of Devonshire Downs before I was into punk, which was the Cramps.
Oh, wow.
And, but I didn't actually see them. I only saw the aftermath, and part of it was a cow tongue out on the floor. And so I wasn't, a big fan of the Cramps. and there were a bunch of singles. It was, the song was called Teenage Goo Goo Muck.
Yeah.
And it was, and I listened to it and I was like, what is this crap? And it was kind of like rockabilly. It was like, I turned into a teenage goo goo muck. And I was, and so I didn't think that was punk, or at least it wasn't the same kind of punk as Fear and Minor Threat and, Black Flag. but, you know, maybe it was punk. I don't know, you know, like in hindsight, but at the time it did not fit into my category of what, you know, what was a real punk band. And then after that, it all becomes a blur because I went to so many shows and did so many different things. Like it was kind of a, it's hard to say what was the next one.
Well, it's also like, you know, just from, you know, just talking to different people and stuff like that, that, you know, especially people that weren't scared straight, like yourself, obviously, that you guys were kind of part of like the next wave of bands that were kind of coming up, you know, like with America's Hardcore and Caustic Cause and I guess NOFX ultimately as well. Like it felt like there was like a shift that was kind of happening around that time. Am I reading that right? Historically, what was going on?
Well, I'm not a punk historian, but I would say that, yeah, there definitely were like 70s bands and then we were an 80s band. Like, mm-hmm. and there was a difference. And the 80s bands, like you said, so in 1985 we went on tour in the summer and our equipment and car and everything got stolen in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So we made it across the country and then we lost everything, and then we played one more show on borrowed equipment in Baltimore. And then it kind of fell apart. Like some of us wanted to go on, but then some of us decided to go home and that was it. And in fact, Brian Walsby became an artist for Corrosion of Conformity, and he was the last straw. Like we were going to go ahead and he wanted to go ahead. And then all of a sudden we all had a plan of going ahead. And then he was like, sorry guys, can't do it. I'm going to move to North Carolina or Raleigh or wherever. I can't remember what he said. And I'm going to be an artist for Corrosion of Conformity, or maybe he said, I'm going to do merch for Corrosion of Conformity and draw pictures. yeah, that was the only time I was ever mad at Walsby, was just because I had just gone through all this, like trying to convince the other people, okay, we can keep going. I'm going to use my dad's credit card. I'll get another guitar. We'll get it. Cause the show we played in Baltimore, I played this PV amp that had zero distortion. So it sounded like a jazz solo, like zero distortion. Was like, but kids still went nuts. So I was just like, you know what? We're here. Let's keep touring. But anyway, Walsby got his dream gig, which was to work for Corrosion Conformity. And he literally, like, he just stayed out there. Like he moved from California to North Carolina and was an East Coast guy for years and years. I'm not sure exactly what path he took after that, but,
Well, it's such a weird thing that happens with him, because obviously, you know, he's in Scared Straight with you guys and you guys go on to become 10-Foot Pole and have massive impacts on in West Coast punk rock and, you know, that whole scene. Then he winds up doing a band, Wax, with Mac, who winds up being in Superchunk, you know, and obviously Mac goes on to kind of have his own thing with Merge and kind of, you know, all their kind of impact they had. And then he does a band with Ryan Adams. And of course, before Ryan Adams gets revealed for being who he is, but obviously Brian Adams had a big impact. And then he turned down being in Nirvana when he got called by the Melvins guys asking if he wanted to take Dale's role as a drummer in the band. And he said he didn't like Bleach. And that was the end of the conversation.
Wow. Well, I didn't hear that story, but but yeah. I mean, you know, I like Brian. He's a good guy, and we had a lot of good times on tour telling stories. And basically, I don't know why, but when we're together, we ended up giggling a lot. Like, you know, where like he'd be reading about Quorthon, this guy, and like, because he would be, read all these metal fanzines, at least, you know, in the 80s, and he'd be giggling about stuff, and I don't know, it was just silly. It was fun to hang out with Brian, and he just made a book called Self and Punishment, and it's pretty interesting. He interviewed a whole bunch of different people who kind of, you know, were trying to like make their way in the world as, you know, it's supposed to be like self-employment, like, you know, like trying to be an artist basically. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's definitely a struggle, especially right now in the pandemic with things, everything shut down, and already it's really difficult. I was even just going through things today with like family members mocking me for poor life decisions I made, which, you know, I mean, this is the absolute truth. Like I went to UC Berkeley and could have been, you know, kind of a professional or probably a good lawyer or something and done something like where I was financially successful. And instead I chose to be a sound engineer for concerts and then a musician and, you know, whatever. And, there's a big price you pay for that. And that's basically what Walsby's book's about. He interviews a whole bunch of different people who are in those kind of situations.
Yeah, no, and it certainly is like, you know, not to undermine or undercut the real, you know, financial severity of stuff that's happening right now. But at the same time, like, you know, if you had gone on to become the lawyer, like, I don't know, like how my life might be different, because finding out that the guys from 10 Foot Pole had been in this band on Mystic Records opened up a huge world to me, you know, like that was a massive gateway. And I'm just one person, you know, there's probably, you know, people like me in every single city you guys played, you know, that had their minds kind of open to it. So obviously the financial reality notwithstanding, but like the impact that you had would be, you know, certainly different in my life had you, you know, wound up being a lawyer.
Yeah. Well, there's so many different possibilities and you know, the reason I do it is that kind of connection with people and that sense of that there are some people who are hoping that I keep writing songs and keep putting out music and, you know, and that's a great feeling, but my brothers do have a point too, that there's a bit of a financial responsibility, like to my kids. Like my oldest son is taking the SAT tomorrow, and it's like, I don't have money to pay for his college. And the reason I don't have money to pay for his college is because I chose to be a sound engineer / musician. Yeah, it doesn't mean that being a sound engineer, you can't have money, but for whatever reason, the different choices that I've made over my life, I tend to overinvest in things when they're going well. Like a couple years back, I was thinking I had a whole bunch of work lined up, like probably the best I'd ever been, and had more than a year worth of income all lined up, which is kind of rare in this business. And so I was thinking, well, since I have all this income lined up, I really need to invest in something that'll be a great write-off. So I bought a tour van, I bought a Sprinter. And the idea being that in between my jobs, I'll try to push the band. Like that'll be a great like side thing to do and whatever. And you know, if you're actually making money as an independent contractor, then the write-off might be like 30%. So basically, if you imagine anything you're about to buy, it's on sale for 30% off, because that money would have gone to the government as taxes anyway. Yeah. So at the time I'm thinking, well, this is just brilliant. Like, you know, cause the cost of renting a van and going on a US, you know, Canada tour is like $5,000. So immediately right out the gate, you know, I buy this van and $5,000 of that would have gone toward a rental, you know, like renting a van and a trailer and like, you know, the whole thing. Like I'm talking about fully like cross Canada and cross the US, like a full on tour. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the minute I bought the van, like not the minute, but like a few weeks after I committed to the van, I lost both of those gigs. both like a whole year worth of income that was lined up, gone. Yeah. Just gone.
Yeah. No, it's definitely like a feast or famine kind of industry. And right now with the way the world is, it's more famine than feast.
Oh yeah, for sure. But even back then, even that was before the famine. And that's why the cover of Brian Walsby's book has people on a roller coaster.
Yeah,
and that's exactly it. Is like 1 minute you're like going up and everything's great, and the next minute it's just crashing, because that's the thing about being owning your own business and all the different risks you take and stuff. Is like 1 minute you're, you know, the top of the world, and the next minute, you know, for whatever reason, you're you know, canceled or, you know, something happens. And both of the jobs that I lost were, I shouldn't say weren't my fault. I mean, everything's always my fault, but you know, one of them was like a company that I worked for lost their whole gig. And the other one was, I don't want to tell, I don't want to say too much details, but it ultimately came down to, it was a very special tour, a different kind of tour. And, it involved an orchestra, and, I decided that someone else would do a better job with me with an orchestra unless we hired an extra orchestra person. And so it basically came down to me saying, I think it's going to better serve the artist if I step back and you get someone who's like an orchestra specialist, because it's an orchestra gig now. Mm-hmm. Or we have to hire someone. But if they hire someone, now they're paying two people, not just paying them, but also the hotels and like all the food and the travel and everything. So ultimately it came down to, it wasn't like I did something wrong and got fired. It was like just the situation changed, and it turned into a year worth of work, a year worth of my income literally gone and not replaced by another job. It was just gone. In fact, what it was replaced by was 10-foot pole touring, which was like losing money instead of making money.
Yeah.
No, for at least 6 months of that year.
Yeah. No, it's the reality of, like you're saying, it's like the, like,
and I still have those van payments to make.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's the reality of, like, you know, investing in your art, you know, and investing in your creativity, and just the fact that it is the most, you know, rewarding, but also risky thing you can do.
Yeah. And if you look through the history of humankind, it's like, you know, there's a lot of people, Shakespeare or whatever, like there's a lot of people who have tried to be on their own. And, you know, sometimes people get picked up by a benefactor or whatever. And sometimes people just starve, and maybe after they're dead, they become famous, and or the poetry they wrote becomes, you know, respected, or the paintings they did suddenly are worth millions, and they, you know, they died penniless or whatever. And, that's kind of the nature of this gig. But it is a choice, and there certainly is responsibility there. And especially as someone who's brought kids into the world, it's kind of like, you know, that definitely weighs on me as my responsibility. And you know, I know that there are other things I could have done, or that from this day forward, maybe I should do. Mm-hmm. But I still have a plan, and I think I'm still optimistic. So we just made an acoustic record, and people love it so far, or either that, or I've just like gotten rid of all the trolls in my bubble. You know, like, so far everyone's like, oh my God, this acoustic record sounds so good. So the it's called Simmer Down, and I mixed it and produced it, and it's the first record that I've mixed and produced. So I'm a live sound engineer, but I had never made a record. And in fact, one time Prince told me, you should make records. Well, actually he said, do you make records? And I said, no, I focus on live sound because I'm a specialist. Like, I'm really good at live concerts. And he just kind of looked at me like, you should make records. And at the time I was a little bit offended, but now that I've done it, I kind of realized what he meant, that there's a different focus when you're making a record, like the amount of intense focus that you do on each part of it can help in the way that you the kind of perception you have about sound. And when you're doing live sound, it's, everything is a mad rush and you don't have time to sit and think about things and make little tweaks. It's kind of like you just do your best under the circumstances, and then the show is over, and then you sleep in the bus. And
yeah.
Well, after you load the truck, then you sleep in, you know, you load the truck, you shower, you sleep in the bus, and then you do the same, you know, unload the truck the next day in a different city. And
it's like two completely different worlds. Like, you know, like I just thinking about how a band operates when it's time to record and write music versus how, you know, you operate on the road. And I imagine working with bands in different situations, you know, both, you know, in front of the microphone and kind of behind the microphone, you know, I guess doesn't really work, that analogy, but anyway, I hope you know what I mean. But like, I imagine you get to see kind of like all sides of that thing.
Yeah, for me, things come down to, I get bored easily, and for me to be really good at something, I need to take a break from it. So, for me to be a good artist, I need to step away and be a technician sometimes. And for me to be a good technician, I need to step away and be an artist sometimes. And the reason is that it's a totally different skill set, and not just the skill set, but the expectations. Like when you're an artist, everyone's looking at you and judging you. And when you're a technician, you're like this anonymous person who's in the back of the room mixing the band, and you just get to focus on the work, and there is no expectation about, you know, do you have a pimple on the on your nose, or, you know, are you wearing bad footwear? The reason I bring up footwear is that sometimes I mix the two of them. Like, I think it was in Germany again. I'll pick on Germany, but so one of the things that I did for a while, I mixed about 500 Jimmy Eat World shows, and a lot of times there were people who were outside waiting for hours and hours to get in. And sometimes I'd go punish them by going outside and playing acoustic guitar and singing 10-foot pole songs. And, you know, I'd always ask for permission. And of course, they most of the time they said yes, because they'd been sitting there for a long time. They're kind of a captive audience just waiting to get into a building to wait longer for the bands to play. And so during my dinner break, I'd step outside sometimes. And I remember one time in Germany, I stepped outside and I had a great set. Like, people were really positive and singing along. And singing along, like, even if they don't know the songs, because I have songs like Don't Be a Dick, where there's a great chorus. It's easy to remember. And I would just tell people, you know, sing, you know, dick, 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 dick right here. And anyway, but after that, I saw there was a picture and a review of me, basically. And then like halfway through was someone was just like, wow, he was so great. His voice was that, but those shoes were terrible. And I was like, I'm a worker. I'm a sound engineer. And I was wearing work boots. It was just,
well, that's also Germany for you, where no matter what, you're going to hear about the one thing that went wrong during this.
His boots were scheisse. No, but it's not just Germany. I mean, that's just the expectation, is that an artist is supposed to be like stylistic, is supposed to be hip, is supposed to be, you know, fashion conscious. And I mean, in punk rock, like, I always kind of thought, you know, anti-fashion or whatever, that I don't have to live by those rules. But the reality is, even in punk, there's a lot of, there's people just expect you to look a certain way. And if you don't, it becomes, for some people, it becomes a, you know, a deal breaker. Like, wow, I can't listen to that guy. He's got work boots on. He's wearing work boots, man. What a dick.
Going back to, you know, when you're first kind of getting into it, was that something that you saw, was like, were people like, you know, fucking with people for having long hair or for, you know, not dressing punk enough type thing? Like, cause it is, you know, a notorious scene for violence. And I find, you know, everyone that comes on that grew up part of, you know, early Southern California hardcore has a real different take on the violence that they were exposed to or that was kind of happening around them.
Well, yeah, I mean, there were several things, there were several aspects of violence in it. I would say one, I remember our guitar player, before he went bald in his older days, had spiky hair and looked kind of like Billy Idol. Mm-hmm. And I remember somebody at the Cafe de Grand giving him a hard time, like, you know, Billy Idol, and our guitar player, he had this total baby face. And he kind of looked up with the, you know, with the scowl, and I remember they were going to go at it a little bit. I should tell you that story. So our very first show at the Cafe de Grand, Mike Thompson was our singer. The guy I was talking about that played music for me. And there was a guy, what was the name of his band? I can't remember now, but he was like a crusty punk. It wasn't Lee Ving, but it was a singer of a band that was not as big as Fear. And I probably shouldn't say the name of the band anyway, but it was one of our first times at Cafe de Grand, and we were, you know, we couldn't even drive. We were like 14, right? And we were playing a punk show in Hollywood. So we thought we were hot shit. We're just having a great time. And we were upstairs at Cafe de Grand, and Mike Thompson's like, oh, we got to come and go sit by this guy. It's the singer of da 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 da. And, you know, he's just so cool. Da da da. And so we went over and sat by him, and this guy was just kind of really quiet. And our singer was punishing him a little bit, but he was just basically a huge fan. He's like, oh, I'm your biggest fan, da da da. And he was like, you know, he was a little guy and he thought he was really tough. And then all of a sudden this singer guy whips out a switchblade and puts it up to Mike's throat and says, shut the fuck up.
Like Mike just kind of like, oh, his eyes got really big and he's like, okay, sir, I'll just get out of here now. And it was a yeah, it was kind of scary, you
Here we
know. That was
go.
like we're down here in Hollywood, and you know, we had like a little bit of a eye opener that, you know, bad things could happen. But it was also fun because that guy was kind of, because Mike was a little guy, but he was also like really strong and he was a good wrestler and he was a bit of a bully. So it was kind of fun to watch him get like just, you know, slapped down so hard by a hero. Like, and that was what made it kind of interesting too, was that like, you know, I'm not even a dick to people who like my band, even if they're really on my nerves. Like I might leave or hide or something, but threatening their life was not on my list of things I might do.
Yeah, I for one am grateful that singers and bands were not dealing with punishers in the 10-foot pole days the same way, because I think I don't know how long I would have lasted.
Yeah.
What was like the that scene like around Cafe de Grand? Because like there are Justice League and America's Hardcore. Like there is sort of like the a bunch of now legendary kind of hardcore bands all popping
Oh,
up
you
from
know
there.
what? I remember now what I was going to say that I didn't say earlier. So in 1985, we went on that summer tour with Ill Repute, and it crashed and burned. But and some people were kind of over it, but I wasn't. I was just a glutton for punishment. So that winter, we went on a short winter tour in Texas and like kind of those areas from LA to Texas and back. And we and one of the bands on that tour or on parts of that tour was NOFX, because you were asking
Oh,
about
yeah.
wasn't NOFX part of that wave. And it was Entropy, NOFX, Scared Straight, and another band that I'm not remembering. Entropy was my favorite band. NOFX was horrible. They musically they were bad, and they were also just really like just psycho. It wasn't that they were so bad, but they had psycho girlfriends, and that there was all this drama, like leather jackets were getting stolen, and you know, like just like kind of the worst stuff you can, you know, just kind of the something you, like you would think that it's like too dramatic to be like real, but it happened. And we went into Mexico and stuff, and they lost one of their guys for a while, and it was a bit funky, but
Was that the weird tour they did where they had another guy singing, where like Mike just played bass? I think I remember
No, I
reading
don't think
about
so.
that in their
This
book.
was years and years ago, and they
Yeah.
were, well, I couldn't tell you. I just remember not being impressed at all. Like they were just kind of like, you know, and Mike would be the first to say that they did suck back then. I mean, that was way before like El Jefe and even like S&M Airlines and stuff. That was way before they were good, basically. And but he kept at it, and you know, more power to him. Like he you know, he's a great songwriter, and he built a label and made a fortune, and you know, it's amazing what blossomed from what basically was a horrible band in the 80s. And 'cause you were talking about the waves, like whether it works in waves. So yeah, that if you call that second wave or whatever, and then the skate punk thing might be third wave, like the NOFX and Scared Straight 80s bands, you know, we're a lot different than we were as 10-Foot Pole and NOFX in the 90s, but not that much different. It was an evolution. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't like a drastic overnight change. It was just kind of like we started learning how to play guitar more, and you know, we became more melodic, and people started caring about singing and pitch and stuff.
Well, that's the thing about Mystic Records to me is like you go through that roster and there's just so many bands, be it, the Minutemen, be it like, or yourselves or NOFX, like bands that blossomed out of bands that were on there or bands that had members that would go on to be in other bands, even the Hernandez Brothers in comics doing, flyers and art for some of those early records.
Yeah, Bad Religion, Battalion of Saints. There was a lot of interesting music. Just the compilations on Mystic Records were interesting, and like I really liked the Bad Religion acoustic songs from back then, which is funny. Like I liked their acoustic songs more than I liked their rock stuff until much later.
Well, they're another band that evolved, right? Like you're saying, like these bands that You know, and that's the thing about the bands that would go on to become, you know, I guess the you know, when punk explodes in the 90s, like, you know, it's all these bands had these long histories, like yourselves, NOFX, Bad Religion. Like, these bands hadn't just popped up, you know, like these bands had kind of evolved to this place where they were like everyone could play, you know, like it wasn't like these mystic bands anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And some of the bands kind of made it and pulled through, and then some didn't. And, but yeah, those ages, I think I remember Circle Jerks also were big for me. We didn't mention that, but you mentioned Keith Morris, but, like Circle Jerks were rad. They were one of my favorite bands live. They never stopped between songs. They would just play like 30 songs in a row. And as a kid back then with boundless energy, it was like we would just get in line and the bouncers would let us up on the stage and we would just do stage diving for the whole set. And it's a much different thing than 10-foot pole. I mean, I don't know whether I'm overdoing it by talking in between songs, but I kind of feel like our audience comes there to kind of have a connection with us. And there are the people in the audience that are just like, shut up and play. But then there's other people who enjoy talking. And so with Simmer Down, with acoustic shows and the whole direction of playing acoustic guitar, I go further the other way. Like when I do acoustic shows, I tell stories like this and I ask, you know, do you have any questions? Sometimes at the rock shows, I do that too, but sometimes people hate it. But if somebody has a question, like, I'll answer it. And I kind of feel like, hey, you paid to get in, you want to see the band, you might have a question about the band. And now's the time to ask, you know, yeah. We're like, I traveled 3,000 miles to be here. Let's chat for a minute, you know, whether that's during the show or after the show or whatever, like, you know, I'd rather have that connection because that's one reason I do it, is to talk with people and connect and kind of feel like we're in this together. It's, you know, life is very alienating. And I kind of feel like being, especially our acoustic version, is really like opening up to, you know, letting the audience be part of the show and saying, hey, please sing along. Do you have any questions? You want to, you know, do you care about the lyrics? Like, do you care about what I was thinking when I wrote this song? You know, yeah. And some people do and some people don't.
Well, it's like you're saying, like, you know, punk is more real than a lot of other types of music, you know, like it's not people just singing about fantasy stuff. In the same way, like, it's real that you can go up and interact with these people. They're real people. And it could be, you know, someone being really nice like yourself, or it could be someone pulling a switchblade on you. But you're not going to be able to find out, you know, whether or not that huge rock star is a dick or not. You know, they keep them away from you at that stage.
Yeah. And sometimes for good reason, although a lot of the bigger musicians and stuff that I've run into as a sound engineer, like a lot of them are really intelligent and friendly people and stuff, but then there are a lot of them who are dicks too. So
yeah, it can go both ways.
it's protecting them. Yeah. And some people want to keep that mystique too. It's like, you know, they want the singer to be mysterious and brooding and you don't know what he's thinking. And, so probably I ruin that for some people by being like, hey, let's talk.
Yeah. What were your memories of working with, you know, speaking of, you know, recording people and people in the music industry, one of the most infamous producers of all time, Doug Moody?
Doug Moody, well, he was very opinionated. He'd be like, oh, kids will love it. Kids love this. And it's all about, like, he's trying to figure out what kids are going to like. And I don't know if he was so much into producing as he was, at least when I think of him, I think more of the marketing stuff that he did. I remember being in a record store and there was a record called Breakfast with Ill Repute and it had like bacon and eggs. And when I saw that, I was absolutely sure that Ill Repute did not make an album called Breakfast with Ill Repute. You know, that's totally Mystic Records going, well, we got these tracks. Let's put out a record. Well, I don't know. What do we want to call it? Breakfast with Ill Repute. So, and then they did that to us, or at least I think they did that to us. When I was in school, I can't remember exactly what year it was, but they said, hey, let's make a record. And we said, oh, okay, that sounds fun. And went to San Diego and recorded guitar like one day or 2 days. I can't remember now. I think it was just one day. And it was like, okay, these are the scratch tracks and we'll come back and fix them and work on it and like make it better or whatever. It was a good start.
And then all of a sudden, at least for me, nothing else happened. And then, I don't know whether it was a year or 2 years later, I was in a record store in Berkeley, and I saw this album, and it said, "Scared Straight, You Drink, You Die, You Drink, You Drive, You Die." And I was like, "What?" And it was like, Scott Rudinsky, pitcher for the Chicago White Sox, was in this car crash, da 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 da, and there was just all this weird, so of course, I bought the record. And I took it and listened to it, and sure enough, it was those songs. Like, they were never really finished, but they were polished up a little bit. And there was all this artwork that had to do with baseball and punk. So, like, for example, there was a drawing of a hand with a baseball, and then it had a spiked leather wrist bracelet. And it was so cheesy, like just this marriage of baseball and punk with spikes and basically like kind of fascist straight edge statements. And I was so embarrassed and angry. And I was just like, oh, Mystic Records, I was so mad. But anyway, so I felt like, that was pretty lame to put out a record without our consent. But in hindsight, it's possible that Scott actually was working with them and that Scott did consent. But he didn't ask me about it. And when I asked him about it, he kind of like pretended to be ignorant about it. So either he didn't give consent, but then, where did they get the photos of his car crash and all? He really was in a car crash, like a drunk driver car crash. So anyway, I suspect that he might have supported it, but then just not wanted to have that confrontation with me about like why we didn't ever have a discussion about the title of the record that our band made.
Well, at least with Mystic, no one got paid off of it. So you don't have to worry about that argument.
Well, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't worry too much about. I wasn't worried about the money. I was worried about being embarrassed, because I was, I was like coming at it from a very different angle than the Nancy Reagan "just say no," you drink, you drive, you die. We're gonna choke you, was kind of the vibe I got. I mean, like nobody's gonna be like, "Yay, drunk driving," but doesn't necessarily mean you want to be like, we're gonna string people up. Anyway, so that was one of the reasons we changed the name eventually. That and that Fat Mike thought, was like, "Hey, you should change your name, because people think you're a straight edge band and you guys aren't straight edge." So,
Were you a
but
strange
yeah.
man in the beginning, though?
Well, isn't everybody when you're 12?
Very true.
I mean, I w not the kind of straight edge that became what straight edge was in the late 80s, early 90s. I mean, maybe some of the guys were, maybe Scott was, I don't know. Maybe he did draw X's on his hands or whatever, but I was raised Mormon, and so I basically didn't drink, for the first, 12 years of my life or whatever, because I was a Mormon kid. And then after that, I got really into wrestling. And so the combination of knowing that the kids who were 13 and 14 who were drinking were kind of dicks, were basically, at least the ones that I ran into at parties who were trying to make me drink, were kind of bullies, and they would get drunk and smash things, and they were basically kind of irresponsible and bullies. And so I wasn't attracted to that lifestyle. And then I got really into wrestling. So I was kind of like, I don't want to do anything that's gonna lose my straight edge of being able to beat, be as good as I can possibly be. Like, I was really into it. And
Did you wrestle
then
collegiately?
eventually,
Sorry, I don't
what's
mean to cut you
that?
off. Sorry, did you
No.
wrestle collegiately?
No. Well, in high school, is that what you, is that collegiate
Well,
or is that
I meant,
college?
sorry, yeah, I meant when you went to Berkeley, did you wrestle as well? But like,
No, actually Berkeley did not have a wrestling team. So that was kind of a hard thing. When I went to college, I could have gone to Harvard, and the Harvard coach told my high school coach that I probably could wrestle first year on the varsity squad at Harvard, even as a freshman, just because there aren't that many like good wrestlers who go to Harvard. And I did really well. But my thinking at the time, which you may or may not have made sense, but my thinking at the time was that, well, I couldn't get a scholarship There wasn't any free ride. They were like, if you come to Harvard, if you, you know, my grades were good enough, I could get in. So you can get in, but you got to pay. But then you can be on the varsity wrestling, you know, squad right away. So that was really exciting. But then there was part of me that was like, well, if my dad takes out loans to pay for me to go to Harvard, I shouldn't sit around and wrestle all the time. Cause they're, like I get kind of singular in focus. Yeah. And so pretty much like if I'm wrestling, I'm going to ignore my other studies quite a bit. And so if I'm on the varsity wrestling squad, I would be totally like just deep into that and not giving a shit about school. And so I was kind of like, well, I don't want to feel like I owe my dad, you know, well, I mean, like literally owe him, but also just feel like beholden to him. While I'm not even like taking advantage of the education, I'm just wrestling. Now, if I knew then what I know now, which is the reason you go to Harvard is not because their education's any better than Berkeley. It's because you might meet somebody who has a dad who becomes president and then he like puts you in his, you know, in his cabinet and you make like $200,000 a year, you know, convincing, like lobbying for oil companies or whatever they do, you know. That's why people go to Harvard. That's why an actress would pay $500,000 to get her daughter to go to USC. It's not because USC is a better school than UCLA. It's because USC maybe has some connections that you end up in the right like crowd. But the reality is I was a punk, like kind of antisocial, not antisocial, but I wasn't going to join a fraternity and hang out with Eric Trump and become like pals and then suddenly get in his dad's cabinet. You know what I mean? Like, even at UC Berkeley, like I didn't go hang out with, there was a lot of conservative kids at Berkeley, but I didn't hang out with those guys and get jobs with their dad's companies. And that's really what the high level of college is about as far as like, why is it worth that much money? So anyway, long story short, UC Berkeley did not have a wrestling team. And I went to visit the campus there the day after they had a huge kind of riot based on their trying to divest UC Berkeley out of South Africa in the apartheid demonstrations. So I went to the campus and there's all this smashed glass and like just crap everywhere from police battling it out with the students. And I thought, wow, this is where I need to be. This is like the cutting edge of, you know, people fighting for justice and equality and, you know, and then of course the reality was at Berkeley, the students had like put so much into that, that for the next 2 years, like nothing happened on campus. Yeah. Everyone was just like studying real hard and like not paying attention to politics and stuff, even though I went there because I wanted it to be about that.
Yeah. It's just funny. Also like looking at Scared Straight, like you've got, you know, obviously Scott goes on to have the baseball career, but even yourself, like, you know, it's rare, you know, at least stereotypically, that you have people in punk bands also taking sports so seriously at the same time and able to kind of split their focus.
Yeah. In fact, in 85, when we went on tour, that was before our senior year. So like I was really into the whole, you know, wrestling and being in shape. In fact, at pretty much at every Scared Straight show, I would go in the pit and mosh during the, we didn't say mosh at the time. We called it slamming, but now they call it moshing, I guess. But during Ill Repute, every night for at least 20 minutes, I would go in and dance, slam, whatever you want to call it, because it was a great workout. Like I would go against the crowd. I'd go with the crowd. Me and Eric, our bass player, would just have a good old time. And it was a lot of fun. It wasn't like the Black Flag, like violent crowd we talked about earlier. It was more like people having a good time and would help each other if they fell down. But it was like, you know, it was sweating. I mean, that was summertime and I was in there for like a half hour. So I was cut. I was like, I had no fat on me. And then I went on to, you know, my senior year of high school was like a big year for, that's when you're going to do the best as far as a wrestler, 'cause you're the biggest, you know, on campus. And it was great. And it was fun to mix the two because I get bored. Did I mention I get bored easily? So that's why I do like as a sound engineer versus a performer. And that's also why. So 10-foot pole is a full like rock skate punk or whatever. And then 10-foot pole acoustic is just something to get away from that, like all the noise and the bashing drums and somebody telling me how to, you know, how fast I have to play everything. The acoustic show, I just whip out an acoustic guitar and I can stop in the middle of a song and tell a story, or I can speed up or slow down or play loud or soft. And there's not like a whole bunch of other noise that I have to include in my kind of calculus. And I love that freedom. And so going back and forth between something like that, like acoustic and rock, or being in a band, or being a wrestler, or being a sound engineer, or being in a band, like, to me, that's fun to shift, to just totally change focus.
Mm-hmm. When you went to Berkeley, I know you're taking school pretty seriously at this point, but were you going to concerts up there as well?
There was some, there was, yeah, there were shows at Berkeley Square. I remember, what's the band? I Care About Nutrition.
Oh, Crucial Youth?
No, it's, how did I forget the name of that band? Because I Care About Nutrition. And it'll come to me later. But yeah, I went to Gilman Street, like that. And in fact, the singer of Rancid, Tim, worked at the pizza place. I'd see him like all the time, because they had pizza was like $1 a slice and it was giant. And that's kind of what college kids survived on. And
was it Blondie's Pizza?
I think he worked at the other one. There was Blondie's. Maybe. I don't remember now. There was, okay, Blondie's, like as you're walking away from the campus, Blondie's was on the right and there was one on the left, and Tim worked at the one on the left, but I don't know if it was Fat Slice.
Okay.
That doesn't sound right, but it could be. I don't know. I mean, it was a long time ago. But yeah, in fact, I got in a fight with skinheads one time at Gilman Street and I couldn't walk. I think it was a Bad Religion show and I couldn't walk for about a week. That was a little rough. And yeah,
well, I was gonna ask, was it like different, because, you know, like obviously it's getting pretty hairy by the mid 80s down in LA at hardcore shows, like was it less violent up but I guess not up in Berkeley?
Most things were less violent. Yeah, I mean, that was pretty rare, but that's because of, you know, a skinhead problem. Like, there's no way I would just get in a fight at a punk show, but there were specifically like skinheads kind of trying to take over the area, and I wasn't having any of it. I wasn't going to bow down to what they were up to. And it's funny, I found out later that the main guy that I was going at it with was like told a mutual friend that I had just totally kicked his ass, and so that made me feel kind of proud of it. But the problem is all his little buddies were like kind of kicking me in the back while I was kind of holding him. Yeah, I had him in a headlock or something. And anyway, I couldn't walk for about a week. So that kind of sucked. But a friend of mine played bass in Mr. T Experience and also Sam I Am. And so, you know, bands like that were playing shows, and Scared Straight still did some shows. So it wasn't over. It just was, you know, I was in Berkeley in that zone. And in fact, Aaron Rubin, who played bass that I'm talking about, played a few songs on Simmer Down on the acoustic record.
Oh, wow. Awesome.
So, yeah. And he actually is a successful lawyer, which is kind of funny because we're talking about the choices and stuff. And I would say, you know, me and him were definitely on like kind of a similar wavelength. He went to Simi High School as I did, and then we both went to UC Berkeley. And we were both in music, but the difference is that he grew out of it after the 90s and I kind of stayed in that scene while he was working at a fancy lawyer job.
Would Scared Straight come up and play in Berkeley? Would you guys kind of do shows during that time when you're going to school?
I don't remember exactly. I mean, yes, we did do some shows like with Lagwagon and Strung Out maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember. I mean, I know we played at Berkeley Square with Lagwagon and Strung Out. Maybe it was Lagwagon and No Use for a Name. I don't remember now. There are just so many different, you know, shows over the years.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, it feels like where point does that new scene begin emerging? Like you mentioned Lagwagon there and No Use for a Name. Obviously, No Use for a Name you know, had been going for a while in different incarnations, but like when did it begin coalescing? And at least in your eyes, that there was this new, you know, like another new scene about to emerge.
I think, well, I didn't think of it in terms of scenes, but when I heard NoFX's EP with The Longest Line, it was kind of mind blowing. Like, wow, that's that band we toured with. Like, this is really good. Like, it was, you know, like the whole, like, I can't remember all the songs on it, but it was like The Longest Line and Kill All the White Man, I think. And it was like, this is really good music. Like, these guys are going to be popular. This is real. Like, this isn't like, you know, I kind of felt like 80s punk was a very specific kind of music for a very specific kind of person or people. Whereas I felt like, at least at the time, I felt like NoFX was just like way more accessible to just average people, which of course it was. And it blew up. And, you know, we didn't try to copy them, but we certainly felt like we wanted to keep up with them. You know, we didn't want to be left behind. And that got us kind of like, wow, we really need to like practice our instruments and like, you know, work on melodies and stuff. And there definitely was a sense of competition. I remember hearing it. I remember being in Scott's Jeep going to a gig, maybe in Santa Barbara or something. Like, we were on our way to a show and he played The Longest Line. And I was like, wow, that's really good. And so at least in my mind, that was kind of the start of the new era, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one band that hasn't come up yet, which is a favorite to talk about on the show, you know, it seems like they would have been a key ingredient to kind of that sound for NoFX, is RKL. And I just wonder if you had any memories of them over the years.
RKL was considered a Nardcore band. They were on that record, I think. They were on the Nardcore comp. And they had a record called Think Positive that was really good. I think it was called Think Positive. I think the song was called Keep Smiling. Keep Smiling. Think Positive. It was a song called Think Positive too. I think the album was called Think Positive, or maybe it was Keep Smiling. I can't remember now. Keep Laughing, that's it. Keep Laughing. I don't remember now. I wouldn't say RKL was a big influence, but we did play with them and have a good time, and definitely like the bass playing was just amazing. But then I think they stopped, and some of the guys became Slang, I think was called. Was it called Slang?
Oh, I don't know. Slang.
I think they were more Santa Barbara.
Okay.
If I recall. But yeah, that one record, I guess, because when we were on Mystic, we got free records from Mystic. And that, whatever it was, Think Positive or Keep Laughing, whatever the record was called, was a Mystic record. So I got it for free, I think. Or maybe I bought it. I don't know. But I loved that record. They were fast and aggressive. And especially the bass playing was like, wow, that's really, you know, kind of like Iron Maiden, but for punk.
Yeah.
Where the bass becomes like kind of the lead. I don't know what you want to say. Kind of like the lead rhythm instrument instead of guitar. Like the guitar just kind of is stable and the bass is jumping all around with all these different notes.
Kind of like where like the bass is like the lead and then it's almost like the rhythm is purely the guitar's function at that point, I guess.
Yeah, it's kind of like the opposite of Van Halen. Like, if you think of the Van Halen song Running with the Devil, he's like on one note through the whole verse. It's just boom, 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 boom. And then the guitar is going dun, 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 dun. Whereas with something like RKL, the guitars might be going like da 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 da, and the bass is going do 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 do, you know.
Yeah.
The point being that, you know, the bass has somewhere to go and then the guitar is just kind of hold still. And that's kind of like how Iron Maiden is too, I guess. Although the guitars do a lot in there too. But, and our current bass player, Richie Petrillo is kind of like that. Like he wants to play every note. And, that's why on Simmer Down, I brought in my friend to play a couple of the gentle songs, just cause like Richie had a hard time not like kind of playing aggressively. And on the acoustic record, I wanted to make it really just kind of beautiful. And, you know, sometimes it's really mellow. And so it was nice to have our guest lawyer come in, Aaron from Sam I Am and Mr. T. And he just like did these like really smooth lines that like no matter how much I pestered Richie, he couldn't. It was just like he had to play every note in the scale and with staccato and energy. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah, sometimes
legato,
the curse of someone term. Playing.
But on the other hand, he also does these rad jumps, which you know, is a lot of punk band is visual, and you know, Richie's a big guy, and he does these huge jumps, and that's great at a show. My dogs are outside; like now, they want to come back in because I'm the only game in town.
Well, I've kept you for a very long time, Dennis, and I want you to know, anytime you want to come back for a part two, the door is always open.
Oh, thanks.
But before I let you go, one thing I'm really curious about is kind of like what it was like kind of going over and seeing, you know, going to Sweden for the first time and seeing, you know, the sound that you guys had been kind of pioneering in California taking hold somewhere so far away, just because, you know, you're obviously a key band early on in that scene. Like what was that experience like going over there for the first time?
I don't really remember Sweden itself, like going over there and having that be any kind of like eye-opening experience. But I mean, certainly the bands like No Fun At All and Mill and Colin, and I think their culture really values melody. Like you get like bands like ABBA that are just like really pop melody geniuses, and you see that in I mean, I shouldn't just say, well, because you're Swedish, you know, you're good at melody, but it seems like it. Like they just take it to a whole new level. Like when I first heard No Fun At All, I was just like, wow, like the Master Celebrator song and some of those were just like, it sounded like the 90s skate punk that, and you know, I could see that where the roots were, but I felt like they in some ways took it and made it better than we did. And so that, you know, part of me was a little intimidated, like, wow, these guys are really like, just like taking it to a whole new level. And Satanic Surfers and like just being super technical as well as really melodic. And so, yeah, you know, I mean, it was interesting to see, like, Sweden, at least my understanding of it, punk rock got really hot there for a while, but then it crashed. Like the audiences didn't care about it. They only wanted to go see raves and stuff. So there were these Swedish bands that came out who were big in Sweden, but other bands, you couldn't really tour there very much. And even I think those bands didn't do as well in Sweden as they would have if they were like German bands in Germany. Like in Germany, there had kind of always been a scene, and so it kind of ebbed and flowed a little bit, but in Sweden it became a huge fad and then it crashed and was kind of over. And I want to say that one year we played there and there were like maybe 1,000 people at a show, and then next year we were there and there was like 40 people. And not because we sucked, like we had a good show, but just the people who were there before were just not long-term punk fans. They were just kind of following whatever was the fad at the time. A scene could be like a flash in the pan, or it could be a long thing with roots. And there's some places like Quebec where it seems like a long thing. And those are the ones that I try to nurture and go back to. And that's why with the acoustic, so I've done one real acoustic tour, and it was kind of in Quebec and parts of Ontario. And that's why, and that's what I'm trying to do now. Once the pandemic's kind of over, one thing I'm trying to do with the acoustic thing is just play in people's backyards, like really like low budget shows, and just take it back to a party. Like, especially if I don't have the whole band there, like if we don't have a lot of, hotels and food and other costs to worry about, if it's just me and a guitar, like if only 20 people show up, it could still be a good show. Mm-hmm. Whereas at a club, you need like more than 100 people to show up for them to break even. And I just want to take that pressure off. Like, I just want to have a good time and go out and play songs. And to me, if I can do it in someone's backyard and only 20 people show up, but I still didn't lose money, safer and better in the long run. And so that's what I'm pushing for now, is like, I'm still trying to do the band thing, but trying to make it so I could do acoustic shows, low budget, and have that connection with people without it being so risky to be out on the road financially. Because I've already got the van. Did I mention I have a van? And I'm trying to show my family that this was not an irrational investment. I'm doing air quotes around the word investment. But that's the basic. I mean, that's something I'd like to say before we split, is like I'm trying to get out there, even just to people's backyards, and just trying to find hosts of people who want to put on a party. And some people think that show's as good or better than the rock show, like the feeling they get from it, from being there. And so I'm trying to see if we can kind of build that. I mean, I don't want to stop doing the rock shows, but it might not be financially possible to do the rock shows, you know, in all the places where I keep trying to go. But if I can, you know, play little backyard parties here and there and just make my way across the country, that'd be really cool. And oh, the other thing I want to say for sure before we go, or maybe you could put it in the notes too, just so that people see it, is I'd like to pump 10footpole.com. T-E-N, 10footpole.com is the place where we have everything, like links to music, links to we have like kind of a fan club. It sounds so lame to say it that way, but we basically have people who want to be patrons of the arts, people who want to support us before we're like well-known and dead artists. Like for as low as $1 a month, you can support us and get in the loop and get some sweet benefits. And higher amounts have different benefits. But so there's, you know, there's the Patreon thing. There's skateboard decks for sale, you know, merch. There's vinyl. There's Facebook and Instagram and all that stuff. But the place to go, the news and everything else, is at 10footpole.com.
Well, anytime you want to come back on and talk more, Dennis, the door's always open. And I really do, once again, appreciate you making the risky financial decision of not becoming a lawyer, because it really helped me kind of get on this path to a risky current situation with kids myself. So thank you for that.
Nice. Well, thank you. I don't know, but if it might not happen because it's becoming so close, but at one point, so we've committed to playing in Europe next summer. And if that happens, we need to rehearse. And my drummer is in Quebec. So I was thinking that to rehearse, instead of flying to Quebec, I should drive there using my van.
Yeah.
And what would be really cool is that if I stopped every couple hours and played in backyards on the way. So that idea was kind of like maybe April-ish.
All right.
So in case you ever want to see like an actual in-person thing, or maybe we could do this like kind of around that time frame if it's going to happen. And try to pump that, like try to get people to have interest in doing it, or to even, you know, if you have a backyard or friends with a backyard and want to join in on a show or something. I don't know whether it'll be possible, but I'm going to keep talking about it until it happens, I hope.
Well, we can set up the track for track acoustic Nardcore, the album cover set in my backyard come April.
Yeah. The Nardcore record. But well, I hope people give Simmer Down a listen. And so far, like I said, like all the responses I've got, people were pretty excited about it. So I hope that translates into people wanting me to actually show up and play a little gig in the backyard.
Thank you, Dennis, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, Dennis can come back whenever he wants. We'll conversate more. And get through this together, this very unsure time. And you know what? From the sounds of it, he didn't shut the door on me booking him to play my backyard for that Nardcore LP acoustic set. And so potentially when hopefully the world returns to some sort of state of normalcy, he will be in my backyard jamming on some aggression songs. Speaking of things that look forward to on the other side of a few days, a scant few days, I will have two members from one band again, when I will have Michael and Vanessa from the band Pylon on the show in celebration of that brand new, incredible looking Pylon box set, which has come out on New West Records. They will be coming on the show and I will be making a weekend of it. You will have two episodes. It'll be like a Pylon weekend. You know, you can check out, two very different perspectives on being in a band. That's why I like doing these two people from the same band episode kind of weekends, because you get two very different stories and ultimately, you know, it's about one band. So there you go. And that is coming up on the show. Don't forget to check out Dennis's Simmer Down acoustic record, which you can hear right now on People of Punk Rock Records. Thank you to my friend, buddy, Melanie Kay, for setting this up. Thank you to Tristan for setting it up. Thank you to you. Thank you to Dennis. Thank you to everyone. Thank you. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives of Indigenous people matter. We need to protect trans people, young trans lives. Right now, it's really important that we all kind of stand together and realize what fascism does is tries to divide and tries to, it's a really an insidious ideology, and it really tries to tear people down, and we need to stand up to it right now. And if that means showing up, if that means signing petitions, if that means donating money, if that means voting, whatever it takes, you know, we need to stand up to fascism. So fuck fascism and get involved right now, please, for all of our sake. Sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you're not going to need them. You're not going to need them anymore. So might as well give them to someone who does, you know. Make something creative. Go out there and make your own culture. Anyone can do this shit. Start a band. Start a podcast. Start a zine. Start something. Wear your mask. You know, like, what does it hurt? Just wear your fucking mask, you know. We'll get through this. We're going to get through this. It might be a long winter, but we're together. And I love you. Stay safe. And bye. See you next episode. A few days. Just a few days. I'll see you in a few days.